Good afternoon. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. If you were interested in what the previous program was, it was a series of sound files from a website called radiolovers.com. And if you go to that address, you'll can find out a lot more about it. You're listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Richard Sanderson, and with Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a fortnightly discussion show covering science and politics. I'm coming from a rationalist, atheist, and progressive left perspective. So we're going to ease you into the weekend, I think, with a discussion today with the socialist Frank Faridi. And I'm going to hand over to my colleague Neil Denny, who's going to introduce him.
Thanks, Richard. Frank Faridi is a professor of sociology at the University of Kent and author of a number of books, including Politics of Fear, Culture of Fear, Therapy Culture, Paranoid Parenting, and Where Have All the Intellectuals Gone? In Politics of Fear, Frank argues that the politics of fear thrives in an atmosphere where the exercise of human agency is regarded with suspicion, if not dread, and that the alternative to this culture of misanthropy is to set about humanizing our existence, or in other words, to humanize humanism. Frank, it's a pleasure to have you on Little Atoms. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
I want to dive straight into Politics of Fear, which is your newest book. You describe one of the conditions of the current political malaise as the public's disengagement from mainstream politics. And one of the reasons for this is the disappearance of clear distinctions between the left and the right. You quote the American sociologist Alan Wolfe as saying, "The right won the economic war, the left won the cultural war, and the centre has won the political war." Can you elaborate a little bit on this, the removal of the distinction between left and right?
Well, I think what has happened over a period of time is there's been a convergence around a number of issues. I think that the first thing that people now accept, or seem to accept, is that, as Margaret Thatcher said, there is no alternative at all. So that seems to be the basic premise of people's imagination. There is no alternative to capitalism. Mm-hmm. And often you find that even people who are fairly radical tend to focus their radicalism on the margins of the prevailing system and very, very, very rarely question the fundamentals. So, for example, I think it's very interesting that a lot of left-wing people that I know are left-wing in the sense of being anti-consumption, anti-against the excesses of the system. And sometimes even sort of make arguments like advertising is bad because advertising makes us discontent. Now, I find that quite curious, because being discontent has always been a creative, radical way of looking at things. And throughout human history, it was people who were discontented who changed the world, who won the right to vote, who challenged racism or slavery. And it was precisely because people were discontented that we moved forward and had progress. And
yeah.
Exactly. And that was really something that the left embraced and quite often saw its creative dimension, whereas the far right and the conservative imagination regarded discontent as a pathology and always told people to accept the way things are, accept your place in life, and that's the way these were. Now, today that has changed, because quite often radical commentators tell us that, in a sense, it's wrong to want to have more, that too much consumption is bad for the environment, or too much consumption makes us unhappy and makes us greedy. Well, maybe, maybe not. Certainly, the vast majority of the planet don't think that they have enough to consume. But nevertheless, that seems to be now an article of faith on the left. At the same time, what's also has happened is that although the right has won the economic war, it's lost the culture wars. So that, for example, all the traditional right-wing values have become empty rhetoric. Every time a politician says, "Let's go back to basics," it becomes a prelude to a set of jokes. Nobody wants to go back to the basics. Mm-hmm. Family values, come across as being a bit of a caricature, and people mm-hmm. often make fun of it. The morality that's usually associated with the conservative imagination is very, very limited and quite empty and quite hollow. So they've lost the culture war, and they haven't been able to manage to influence our moral life in any or intellectual life in any serious sense. And I should also add that even so-called neoliberalism, which people often talk about as a problem, is very weak and very feeble. I mean, how many times do you hear anybody saying, "We love capitalism"?
Sure.
you know, sort of capitalism, a great system. You know, that doesn't happen very much. So that has happened, and at the same time, what you have is a situation where, as people with any kind of political beliefs have become marginalized, so you have the entry into politics of the celebrity, of the businessman, of the manager, of the personality, of the individuals, and politics has become increasingly this kind of amorphous managerial sort of system of micropolitics, which has got no mission, has got no purpose.
It sounds like you're almost implying that it's actually got very bland. I mean, I'm thinking of things like, you know, Blair's Third Way, in which he tried to sort of steer away between the left and the right. But also you're suggesting by having recourse to celebrity and so forth, it's actually just become, it's almost realizing that it's a bit boring. It's often admitting that politics is a bit dull.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think it's a way of acknowledging that if you cannot set an election, a general election campaign on fire, you call up Jamie Oliver and ask him to organize a campaign on school dinners, and that will get people moving, that will get people talking. Or you get Sir Bob Geldof to, you know, sort of go on about poverty in some part of the world, and that might get people moving. And that just tells us that there's an acknowledgement of basically of irrelevance on the part of the political class, and the introduction of essentially, you know, sort of basically personalities with some kind of entertainment value who kind of become the modern equivalent of the Roman circus.
Well, I want to return to the idea of the sort of rise of the sort of celebrity in political life later, because I think that's quite interesting. But let's go back to the idea of the disengagement, people being disengaged from the concept of politics. And I'm sure you could say to somebody in the street, you know, are you political? And they would say, yeah, absolutely I am. You know, I didn't vote in the last election because all politicians are the same and they're all out for themselves. But, you know, I'm a member of Greenpeace. I'm a member of CND. I marched against the war. I go on, I don't know, animal rights protests. So people are sort of politicised around these sort of single issue ideas, which seem to have replaced the big idea. So what's happened to the big ideas in politics?
Well, I think there's two issues here. First of all, even single issues are not nearly as intensely politicized as they were maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Sure. And one of the ways you can tell that is that, you know, when I was a student radical and you had a demonstration of 20,000 people, it wouldn't make the TV. It would be self-consciously censored by the authorities, and they might talk about it the day after. Today, when you have a demonstration of 300 people, you know, it will become a major event on Sky News, and they will talk about it and actually interview the demonstration organizers. I mean, I've organized numerous demonstrations in the 70s and the 60s. I've never been anywhere near a TV camera because that was the last place people wanted to be in. So I think that it's important to keep things in perspective. Even single issues are real kid stuff today compared to another period. And I think the big ideas, as you imply, are not there because there is no political movement that has an orientation towards the future that actually says, this is the kind of society we would like to create. You know, this is how we're going to achieve it. You know, sort of, what do you think? There's no conversation. There's no asking of the big questions.
So you're saying that we've lost a kind of utopianism?
Not even often the belief that you can change the world is called wrongly a utopia. You know, not only utopia. All we're saying is that the world will be better tomorrow than yesterday. I'm just merely saying is that we've lost the capacity to engage in the kind of purposeful activities that could to some extent alter the way we live and give some direction to our life. And particularly, we've lost the belief that we can have a degree of control over our fate. You know, we no longer believe that fate is something that we can manage and overcome. We are seeing it in a much more subordinate, you know, sort of passive role than in the previous.
You've written quite a bit about this recently, and you've basically been talking about a kind of culture of doom-mongering, I think you once described it as, in the sense that I think you mentioned James Lovelock and his concept that the world is, you know, we've had it, basically. We might get another 100 years or something, but that humanity is doomed.
Yes, I think it's very interesting because historically it's been the people of religious conviction or the Malthusian conservative imagination that told us that this is it, that we're now reaching the end point. Whereas today it's become almost conventional wisdom that we have too many people living on the planet and that human activity on the planet is by definition necessarily a regressive and destructive act. And I think as a result of what has happened is that we now have a narrative of human action, which instead of being purposeful and constructive, is by definition destructive and negative. And I think when you regard human activity in that kind of a way, it's unimaginable that you can have a future-oriented political sort of movement. What you will end up having is just a conservative desire to stay in the present.
Mm. Well, when do you think this changed then? Because it's obviously you speak a lot about the Enlightenment, and it is a sort of progressive idea that you describe nature as the progressive idea of nature being viewed from the perspective of its utility for people. So. Now we're talking about the concept, and you mentioned the words like ecocide, and you've just described how we describe the eco footprint, about our impact on the environment in a sort of destructive way. So when do you think, at what point did we change from seeing nature in a sort of the progressive, it's there as a sort of adjunct to mankind, to being like we're only one other, the concept of speciesism, we're only one other species. Where did that come from?
Well, I mean, the ideas about it in the abstract began a long time ago, already in the late 60s, early 70s. But these were fairly marginal views that inspired a relatively small minority of people. I think what has happened is that as conventional politics and as radical politics began to lose their way, people began to become very disoriented about handling social issues. Mm. And gradually, by the early 80s, what you will find is that first in intellectual circles, but then later in political life, the social dimension of our life is being displaced by the natural one. So increasingly, social problems are being redefined as problems of nature. And I think you get to a point today where the problem of nature becomes the problem of our times, and where the biggest hooray word for everybody, if you want to get a standing ovation at a meeting, you use the word sustainable, and all you got to say is sustainable communities, sustainable development, and everybody say that's brilliant, that's wonderful, not realizing that it's a completely inane concept, because all that it possibly could mean is marking time. It means stasis, remaining in a stationary state, whereas in fact, from a creative dimension, the last thing you will want is sustainability. You want to have a different orientation towards life.
We talked about the lack of distinction between left and right, and I mentioned the sociologist Alan Wolfe. In the same part of your book, you mention the right's abandonment of the past is matched by the left's refusal to embrace the future. And we've obviously discussed about the right sort of abandoning its cultural ideas, the sort of back to basic stuff. What exactly do you mean by the left being scared to embrace, particularly the political left being scared to embrace the future?
Well, I think that the left has, in a sense, given up on the whole importance of human agency. Mm-hmm. I think that, to me, the most attractive aspect of left-wing politics when I got involved was the belief that human beings made history, that history wasn't something that happened to people, but that was, in some shape or form, the product of human activity. And through that, people altered their circumstances, altered themselves. And that has pretty much gone. We have a very one-sided, feeble rendition of what a human person is, what people are about. And therefore, under those circumstances, the future can no longer be seen as being exciting, as an improvement of what goes on now. But it's seen in more of a conventional dystopian kind of a way, and that's why I think you will find that often in left-wing sort of political discussions, whenever they talk about the future, it comes with a health warning.
So the left is also harking back to a sort of a golden age as well, is it? I mean, you think that would be ordinarily a right-wing conceit to think of, the idea that the past was better.
Well, it's a very paradox, because the left actually doesn't hark back to a golden age, because that would make it feel very uncomfortable. Sure. I mean, if you actually looked at what the real left did in the old days, you would feel, that what you're doing is pretty much kid stuff, and you wouldn't feel very good about that. So it's more or less written off the past in a very strident, unhelpful kind of a way. It's also written off the future. And I think what's interesting about people call themselves left-wing is that they are heavily living in the present. They're very presentist in their imagination. And I noticed this because when I wrote my book on the intellectual, the role of the intellectual and on intellectual life, and I criticized contemporary cultural institutions like the university, I often get criticized by the left. How could you say that? You know, you want to go back to a golden past. You know, universities have never been as good as they are now. You know, we have universities where everybody's got a voice that never voiced in the past. It's almost like you have a situation where the so-called left is actually more conservative than the right, because the right at least wants to go back to the past. You know, not really possible.
Yeah, there is some movement.
There is some, you know, potential movement, but whereas the left thinks this is like the best of all possible worlds, you know, sort of.
Well, I'm just interested in the idea of them wanting to go back even further than that, and the idea of sort of the environmentalist idea almost of like a sort of pre-agrarian sort of golden age. And we mentioned Thomas Malthus before, and it does seem that the idea that, of getting back to that sort of, you know, almost the concept of serfdom or whatever can't really happen without there being a massive reduction in population. And this is, you know, this is obviously quite a shocking concept. It's an anti-human concept.
Well, it is, and I think especially when you read books that talk about die-offs of mm-hmm. millions in very relaxed, laid-back terms, you know, when people, you know, sort of instead of seeing human beings as two pairs of hands that can solve our problems, merely see them as more mouths to feed and, mm-hmm. and, you know, and as the problems.
It's quite horrific, especially when you think that the, you know, that possibly the defining thing of the 20th century was the Holocaust, and that was, you know, it's quite rightly considered with such horror that people are now lightly tossing around multi-death figures.
Well, they are, and I think it's almost has a religious connotation to it. It's almost like a new kind of left-wing version of the fall of man, you know, it's kind of being revisited. And what you have is a kind of radical narrative of the apocalypse, but without any kind of salvation at the end. Just
the
merely,
revenge of Gaia.
Just the end, just a dim, dismal end, and that's it.
So, I mean, the idea you mentioned about this as a concept of the fall of man, and you've written about the other myths about the sort of the deluge and the sort of Sodom and Gomorrah, and these sort of things are, you know, myths. These things, sort of things didn't happen, presumably didn't happen, or certainly didn't happen on the scale that they're written about. But things like global warming might not necessarily be happening to the extent that the scaremongers would have us think, but it clearly is happening in certain degrees. So let's talk about the idea of you know, humanity and science being able to perhaps, you know, tackle problems that face humanity and perhaps, you know, could wipe out humanity by using science and progress rather than saying, like the James Lovelock put your hand up, we're all going to die idea.
Well, I think there's a very important issue here, because whenever we're talking about any impending natural disasters or humanly created disasters, we assume that everything gets from bad to worse, rather than the fact that at the very least, you know, human beings learn from their experience, mm-hmm. and at the very least, human beings learn and manage a capacity to deal with things. So just to take a current example, the avian flu, where we were continually told that in 1918, 50, 60 million people died. It's going to happen again.
Sure.
Don't see why that needs to happen again, because mm-hmm. you know, in the meantime, you know, we have learned a lot about public health. We know about science.
Sure. There's vaccines.
There's vaccines, but also we, you know, there's been evidence from recent years of West Nile sort of virus, of SARS. You know, and when you think about it, we dealt with those things pretty effectively. Mm. I mean,
well, those things disappeared as quickly as they came along, really, didn't they? In terms of the media coverage, presumably people in Africa still get West Nile disease, in terms of the media scare, those things went away as quickly as they came.
They did, but also I think the public health intervention, particularly with the West Nile virus, was very effective. I mean, it was really one of the few, you know, sort of inspiring examples of how you deal with a problem like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even in Hong Kong, when the chicken sort of flu broke out, I mean, hundreds of scientists went to Hong Kong. People don't know about it, and they really talked and reflected on it. And I think that the way they handled it, with minimal loss of life, you know, less people died of it than people die of eating Marks and Spencer's kind of sandwiches in a year or prepared food, you know, showed us that, you know, we can deal with these things. And why not you know, celebrate that?
Indeed, I mean, it's one of our. It's pretty much a touchstone stroke cliche of this show, and I think we managed to get this question into virtually every one of our guests. Do you think there's an anti-science feeling abroad? But do you think there's an anti-science feeling around, or you know, that science is undervalued?
Well, yes, Yes and no. Interesting thing is that everybody uses science. So the most profoundly anti-scientific movements try to prove their case by using science. I mean, a lot of people that tell us that the global warming will destroy Britain tomorrow, you know, rely on so-called science to kind of make their point. So at one level, science is accepted. What there's a lot of hostility to is what I think is the really good thing about science, which is scientific experimentation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love science because of its experimentative edge, because it has the capacity of changing our world, of solving problems, and throwing up new questions. But these days, we are extremely suspicious of experimentation. In fact, I did a Google search, and I put in scientific experiment. And I can assure you that if you do that yourself, you'll find that what will come up immediately are, like, you know, the experiments of the Nazis,
horror stories,
yeah. The Tuskegee experiments, all dismal, horrific stories. That's what you think of scientific experiments, rather than the invention of a drug against polio or this or that. None of the good news comes across.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this struck me fairly recently. And of course, I've forgotten the name of the scientist concerned, but there was fairly recently a scientist who worked on vaccines, and he died, and there was an obituary of him in The Guardian, and they estimated this guy must have saved the lives of millions and millions of people, and yet he's unknown. I mean, I can't even remember his name, and I think this is an extraordinary fact, really, that science is devalued to this extent, that people, that it's saved such an enormous amount of lives in the last century, medicine especially.
That's right, and very recently there was a story of these people in California who injected themselves with some kind of HIV virus or something as a way of trying to find some cure for AIDS, mm-hmm. which I thought was, you know, very heroic, you know, a very heroic attempt to deal with these things. And what's happened?
It's a scary version of the Helicobacter story, isn't it?
And what happened to these people? You know, did we celebrate them? Did we learn from them? I don't know.
Didn't hear any more.
Yeah.
Well, we were. We were talking, Rich and I were talking before the show about the idea of the measles epidemic. That's, you know, there's an impending measles epidemic coming, and people have, you know, gone against the idea of inoculating. And this is obviously one of the one of the side effects, isn't it? We're seeing the return of diseases that you would have thought were pretty much eradicated 10 or 15 years ago.
Yes, I mean, I think I am really sad about this because. Vaccinations are one of the safest forms of public health intervention. If you look at the whole history of vaccinations, they've done a phenomenal amount of good, particularly for children, you know, who have been spared from a lot of very difficult diseases of childhood. And I'm just really astounded that we've come to the point where it's almost become fashionable amongst parents to be anti-vaccine. That's like a symbol of being enlightened somehow. Mm-hmm. You're a good parent because you don't
because
let
you're
you
not sticking poisons into your child's
that's
arm.
Right. It's more natural than relying on this form of intervention. I think it's just really sad when we simply and so readily give up on such an important gain for our culture.
This actually reminds me of you wrote a book called Paranoid Parenting. Was that one of the things that you were talking about in there? And was that from your own experience as a parent?
Well, that's right. I've never been interested in parenting, and nor will I ever assume authority to tell others, you know, how to parent. But, you know, when I had a young son late in life, I was completely shocked to realize how childhood had changed. And, you know, from the moment of conception, you know, there was all these difficulties and all these risks and all these dangers threatening children. And I was really shocked to see the way in which instead of parenting being a normal routine, even banal experience, it almost becomes a trial where you're kind of confronted with all these dangers that you got to protect your kid from. Mm-hmm. Which basically, you know, sort of, I think, has got the consequence of leading to a situation where both parents and children are regarded as incompetent individuals who cannot be trusted to do their own, you know, own business without the help of professional intervention.
And the innocence of the child is this thing that's got to be protected above all else.
That's right. Whereas, in fact, what kids need is they need to be, you know, they need to just run, you know, run with it. And the best thing that we can do as parents is to let go at a very early age, and allow kids to, you know, learn for themselves from their experience with other kids. Because children learn best when they interact with people their age to learn about their strengths and weaknesses. They don't need you and I to hover over them and immunize them from the experience of life.
Indeed, I mean, I imagine it would then be, life's going to be a lot more of a shock if they're suddenly thrown out at 16 and have to deal with it.
Obviously, we have this concept now of the sort of the super nanny as well, and the House of Tiny Tearaways. So there are to an extent self-appointed experts who are there basically telling you that, yeah, this is again something I want to return to in the second half, the sort of the rise of the celebrity culture. But how do you feel about this, about this rise of the sort of super nanny?
Well, I think it's very regressive, because whether they like it or not, they have the effect of telling parents and others that you are just bumbling amateurs, mm-hmm. that these are very difficult, complicated tasks that only somebody with special skills could possibly handle. And I think that just diminishes our own confidence, and therefore its impact is very, very regressive.
Mm-hmm. So really, we're all bumbling amateurs, I suppose. I mean, it is, to anybody that has a child, everybody is a bumbling amateur, aren't they? Because...
Yeah, well, so what?
Absolutely.
we're bumbling amateurs at making friends and finding lovers, all aspects of life.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Sam. I'm at the moment in the middle of the adoption process, and it's quite interesting just how, as you go into this, you're made to feel pretty incompetent. You really are told that, it's going to be the hardest thing that you will ever do, which I'm certain it is, but you actually are almost feel like you're not going to be able to do it. It's an extraordinarily depressing experience, I have to say.
But also there's a presumption that this person who is monitoring you actually knows more about children than you do. Mm-hmm. And that's not really how it works, because knowing about children or knowing about relationship is something that comes with sensitivity, keeping your eyes open. And it's a very specific experience. There's no science a relationship, as far as I'm aware of that. That's the wrong area to kind of bring in science, because all that it can do is to flatten out what is a very ambiguous kind of process.
Sure. Should we pause for some music at this point?
Yes. Well, I brought in a record. It's by Nina Simone, and it's a version of the song Mr. Bojangles, because we were chatting to you earlier, Frank, and you mentioned the song, although it wasn't actually this version you mentioned, but you said you had some kind of an experience with it. So could you expand on it just slightly before we play it?
Well, I heard this song at a very important time in my life, when I was up one night listening to public service radio in America. And I listened to this song beforehand, but I never actually heard the words before. I just kind of listened to it. And for some reason, I kind of lingered on and paused and listened to the words. And I was just completely caught so unaware by it. And I was so overwhelmed by what I thought was a simple message and its clarity, that I realized that, it was about time that I grew up and started listening to music.
Right. And what was the version that you heard?
This was a version by David Bromberg, who is a good friend of Jerry Jeff Walker, who wrote this song.
It, yeah.
And David Bromberg wrote it's a 15-minute version where, in the middle of the song, he explains how Jerry Jeff went about writing it. It's a very funny, humorous version.
Oh. Oh, well, this isn't the 15-minute version. It is still quite long. It's about 5 minutes, and it's Nina Simone doing Mr. Bojangles.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. Worn-out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt, and baggy pants. The old soft shoe. He jumped so high, jumped so high. Then he lightly touched the ground. I met him in a cell in New Orleans. I was life I dance now at every chance and honky-tonks for drinks and tips. But most of the time I spend behind these county bars. He said, I drink some beer. He shook his head. As he shook his head, I heard someone respectfully ask, please, Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles.
Jaunty ending to that, which I'd completely forgotten about. That was Mr. Bojangles by Nina Simone, and the song, anyway, was the choice of our guest, Frank Faroudi. You're listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Richard Sanderson, and with Neil Denny. And Neil's going to bring Frank back into the discussion.
Thanks, Richard. Well, one of your books, Frank, the Therapy Culture... We were talking before about the rise of the sort of celebrity, the celebrity guru, and how, well, you mentioned in an article that this is one of the sort of reasons for this is the sort of the end of the concept of deference in terms of the, you know, politics and the royals and things, and but also the sort of the authority figure of doctors and scientists, how that's going, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but. You wrote an incredibly moving article about it was about Holocaust Memorial Day, but basically the bit I want to raise is you talk very movingly about your own family's experiences of the Holocaust and the Nazis, but you mentioned the fact that when you talk to your mother now about her experiences, she's astonished by the idea that people would consider her to be a victim of the Nazis. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting that when you look at the whole experience of the Second World War, when people left the concentration camp, they were pretty much seen as being kind of sad individuals who suffered quite intensive pain, but not necessarily all that different to prisoners of war or other people who have been under these terrible conditions. And I think it's very, very interesting that when you look at the experience of many of these Holocaust survivors, that they often survive by using comedy, you know, by dreaming about the future, by trying to think about how they're going to start new families. And, you know, many of them, certainly my mother and her girlfriends, all looked upon this event as something that you wanted to put behind you. And therefore, I was, you know, quite astounded when, you know, sort of in the last 25, 30 years, people like my mother began to be, you know, sort of recast into this pathetic victim role. You know, mm-hmm. So somehow, because you were in the Holocaust, that conferred an identity upon you, which defined your very existence. And I remember once my mother telling me, she was really quite upset, and she was saying, I just watched this TV program about a bunch of American survivors who went back to Auschwitz, and they all call themselves victims. And she says, well, I'm not a victim. I never felt like that. You know, is there something wrong with me? And I think, you know, to me that was a really powerful statement, because mm-hmm. basically what she was saying was that, you know, as far as her own experience was concerned, she regarded herself in essentially positive terms. This wasn't an event that destroyed her or turned her into this supplicant. And certainly she wasn't prepared to go along with this representation of survivors in that kind of a sense. And I think that it's a shame that we're discouraging people from sort of perceiving themselves in this more active sense.
But presumably a modern therapist would say, well, there is something wrong with you. You know, you're sort of subliminating these old ideas. You need to sort of talk about it. You need to, and all of this sort of thing. And that's obviously completely different from the idea of something bad's happened to me. You know, it's in the past. Let's get over it. So, when do you think this started to change?
I'm not really sure. I think that the big change begins in the 60s and then accelerates in the 70s. And it's really in the 70s and the 80s that people are told that they're in denial. Mm-hmm. You know, that they really are suffering all kinds of pains, but, you know, they don't acknowledge it. And it's really in the 80s that we kind of tell people to acknowledge your pain and to bring it all out into the open. And in many respects, I think it's important to realize that this form of therapeutic intervention isn't really an intervention that brings out into the open something, a hidden pain that's in the inside. Mm-hmm. But rather, it's a way of redefining human beings by inciting them to only see the worst, to only talk about their most negative, destructive experiences, and to somehow minimize the other aspect of their life.
It's interesting as well, because that brings to mind that another word I'm not at all keen on, closure. Do you have a feeling on that word? I mean, I've always thought closure doesn't work. I can't see how you vote if you've opened something up like that, that it's in fact closing it off. I think it's merely perpetuating it.
Yeah, I think what the professional intervention into our life does is it turns life into technique. So you have when somebody dies, you've got a grieving process, mm-hmm. right? You don't just mourn or cry or feel unhappy. You've got a grieving process. And then, according to these experts, the grieving process, you go through different stages that are pretty much, you know, exist on a template. And then you get closure and you kind of move on. Mm-hmm. But this is just really a professional script that is the invention of the professional imagination, which we're meant to live up to, rather than allowing our own experiences and our own feelings to dictate our own kind of reaction. Because sometimes there is no closure, and that's not a problem. Why should you forgive somebody, or why should you forget something? What's wrong with pain and suffering? I mean, that sometimes you're entitled to feel really hurt because of the nature of the experience that you went through.
And I suppose In the best one in the world, something like the Holocaust, you know, it happened, people suffered through it, and people did, you know, suffer pain that they would deal with in different ways. But I suppose the extension of what we're talking about, therapy, is the idea of therapy for things that didn't happen. For instance, there's been the rise of the satanic abuse and the idea of sort of the recovered memory syndrome of therapists that have set themselves up to basically say to people, something terrible happened to you that's, you know, controlling every aspect of your life, but you don't know about it. So what do you think of this phenomenon?
Yeah, I think that that goes back to our previous discussion about our sense of degraded humanity. I think this is really going back to the medieval way of looking upon human beings when we looked at for demons and we looked at other kind of supernatural forces and we looked at witches and other people who polluted our lives. In many respects, the whole way that the discussion on child abuse and satanic abuse has evolved has really lent itself to this expansive sense of destructive imagination, and I think that therapy has contributed to that by legitimizing it.
But there's also an industry here, isn't there? Because as it's probably just a coincidence, but paralleling the sort of the destruction of the sort of large industries in the West, there's been this rise not only of service industries but the concept of the concept of the therapist, and you mentioned in your writing that pretty much anybody can become a therapist. I can set myself up as a crystal healer, for instance, and I don't have to be I don't have to know anything about rocks. I don't have to be a paleontologist, a geologist. Exactly, to do this. So I can be an expert in the concept of crystal therapy, but of course I'm not an expert in anything because there's not a subject there to be an expert in.
Well, I think that's right, and it seems to me in any case that even if you were if you had a PhD in geology, you have no right to make pronouncements about human relationships.
Sure.
Because that's not something, we know, for example, there are many experts on sex, and there are millions of books written on how to have a better sex life. It doesn't mean that just because you read those books, you are going to have a better sex life. If it did, then there'd be a lot of happy people around, sort of having a fulfilled sex life. So, when it comes to relationships, these are very intimate, very unique set of circumstances that in the end can only be resolved by the people that are involved in that. Okay, a friend can give you advice. Maybe, your work colleague will say, Frank, don't do this, do that. And there might be some, wisdom in that.
Mm-hmm.
But expert, you can't, the idea of being an expert about relationship, it completely violates the meaning of what an expert is.
This kind of brings us round to one of your current sort of favorite topics, which is this idea of happiness and perhaps the concept of happiness being a right and something that the government should be legislating for and making us all happier. Could you expand a little on these ideas?
Yeah, I think as you probably know, the government and all these people are promoting happiness as the object of government policy. For example, many government departments are drawing up happiness indexes to indicate the impact of policies on people's happiness. And what it really reminds me of is a very kind of, this infantilized set of kind of political life really reminds me of what happens when you, as a youngster, you go to nursery and you kind of sing the song, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. And people clap their hands. And that's pretty much at the level at which, the whole arguments and the discussion about happiness kind of proceeds, because happiness is not something that you can get, in a shop. You can't buy happiness. Happiness is not something that you can gain through a particular policy. Happiness is something that is always external to what we're trying to achieve, and it kind of catches us unaware.
Mm-hmm.
It's a momentary, fleeting emotion, and its intensity, in a sense, comes about precisely because it's so rare. And the very idea that you can now formulaically, sort of cater to people's happiness indicates the very degraded way in which policymakers operate, that they think that politicians should be therapists, in a sense, rather than public officials, who kind of organize discussion and debate for an educated public.
Is it not just the government or whoever basically saying, well, we've achieved most of the stuff that we wanted. We've lifted the vast majority of people and not in dirt poor conditions anymore. So this is just the next step up. We've got them out of poverty. Now we'll make them happy.
Well, there's something in what you say. It's not, obviously, the government hasn't achieved everything that we need. That's certainly true. But I certainly think that the government must sit around and say, what the hell are we going to do?
Mm.
You get the impression that there are all these guys, kind of write up and dream up policies and write them on the back of a cigarette pack and pass it on to Tony. What do you think of this? And I think somebody must have come along and said happiness. That's, you know, not a very controversial...
You can see the appeal of it, though, can't you? I mean, you can see why somebody would say, well, this is an achievable game, much more than unhappiness is. I mean, we don't want to be unhappy, so I suppose the opposite would be happiness. You can see a sign of simple-minded logic to it.
Very simple-minded. I mean, it's like saying, let's have a policy about being nice, you know. A nation of nice people.
It's arguably already happening, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Well, that was the there was a film, there was a Kevin Spacey film, I can't remember what it was called, where the concept was that, you know, if you were just nice to the next person that came along the world, and I've never seen it, but I presume the world did get better in the course of the film.
Part of me does think it's not such a bad idea, I have to say. I mean, being nice to people, but it's kind of also one that hopefully people just do anyway, without it actually being something that you necessarily need to be told to
do. It comes back to again, it's the sort of misanthropic idea and the sort of idea that the government is like paternalistic and that people can't be trusted to run their own lives. And one of the other major topics of your research areas and your writing is the concept of risk and the idea that people need to be protected at all times from sort of any form of risk. Can you expand on this a little?
Well, I think that we live in a very risk-averse culture, and we're continually told that any element of uncertainty needs to be very, very heavily policed. Mm-hmm. And we're increasingly told that human beings are too vulnerable and too feeble to be able to handle uncertainty. Just this week, for example, you probably read about the gradual banning of ice cream trucks near schools and everything on health and safety grounds. And you think about it, you know, sort of, I mean, generations and generations of kids have looked forward to kind of getting stuck in and, you know, licking an ice cream cone that they got from the ice cream van. Now that's going to go.
Although, oddly enough, it also makes me think of one of the earliest road safety adverts, which was a Tufty one where a hedgehog or something gets run over running for an ice cream outside the school. So it's obviously an old scare.
That's right. The hedgehog obviously has had the last word.
So let's talk about some more of the examples of the risk culture, the sort of things that I need to be protected from myself, basically.
Well, basically, the risk culture is based upon the fact that we can't trust ourselves.
Sure.
And although risk issues are often seen in very global environmental terms, they really are about human relationships, that we cannot trust each other, and which is why it's interesting that the metaphor of toxicity, of being toxic, you know, is also focused on, you know, toxic parents, toxic lovers, toxic colleagues. It's almost as if we kind of pollute each other.
Sure.
And to me, the way that I see it, in the picture, the way I visualize it, is I always think of the day when I got my job at my university in Kent. And I remember getting to the bus stop there, and in those days, you would have 50 or 60 students all queuing up. I couldn't understand why are they queuing up? And they were all hitchhiking, because that was the dominant mode of transportation. It was a very social way of meeting people, you know, because, you know, you get in a car with a complete stranger sometimes, mm-hmm. and you talk to them, but nevertheless, that's how you got around, you know, sort of, if you're a university student. Today, you will not see a single individual hitchhiking. That's gone, right? That's...
Certainly, I mean, you notice them if you do see one. It's
very odd, eccentric people. And I think what has happened is that a very social, even socially responsible activity has just been banned out of existence because we now think it's too risky to stop a stranger in a car, because strangers are by definition dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Danger.
Exactly. And what we're doing is, because of our pathologization of human relationships, you know, we change the way that we live. And I could give you hundreds of these little stories of things that you could do before you can no longer do because of the way that risk consciousness works and the way that alters our life and distances you and I from one another.
Do you think there's any way we can reverse it, though, Frank? Because, I mean, you know, when I read the papers and stuff, I just see even more scare stories and more terrifying things. I mean, take, for example, the recent scandal, inverted commas, of supposedly hundreds of paedophiles in our schools. You know, this seems like yet another story, which is now going to, you know, now makes people very worried about, you know, their teachers being left alone with children, which seems like an absurd thought, but, you know, it's actually starting to happen. Do you think there's any way we can reverse this, or is it actually just getting worse and worse?
Have you
optimistic in any way?
Well, optimistic in the sense that, you know, there are good reasons as to why it is that these scares, you know, are so deeply embedded in our society. And they're not based upon the fact that teachers have suddenly turned into monsters. Mm. It's got to do with the way that our culture frames, you know, our humanity and our relationship, and the way that's become institutionalized and politicized. I think that this needs to be challenged and can be challenged, because I often meet a lot of sensible people, for example, about children, who know deep inside that there's something fundamentally wrong when they cannot send their 13-year-old daughter out on the streets, you know, to buy a bread from the bakery, because kids are not allowed on the street by themselves. They know that there's something, this is weird. You know, I used to go out, you know, to buy bread when I was 6 or 5. Why can't my daughter do it when she's 13? So there's a lot of people that understand that many of these regressive features are actually quite harmful. The trouble is, at the moment, they haven't got a voice. And most importantly, at the moment, people are really scared to ask the questions that need to be asked. It's almost like we need more little boys that basically ask the question, you know, why is the emperor not wearing any clothes? It's as simple as that. And people are really scared to do that. I mean, just this week, right, you might have heard a story about this old codger in his 70s who has been denied treatment by the NHS because he's got strong anti-abortion views. And he's been bombarding the health professionals with scary images of fetuses. Now, I'm for abortion, the right to choose. But the idea that you don't let an old guy like this have access to health services because of his views indicates that we have such a reactionary attitude towards freedom of speech, that we're so judgmental about human behavior that, you know, that it's just getting out of control. And I think that once we begin to ask, well, why aren't you letting this guy have a health, you know, health access to health?
It's interesting, though, because the sort of things that you're saying there, although we've said, you know, this idea that there isn't a left and a right anymore, the people that would defend that man are more likely to come from the right, aren't they?
Well, they would, but then, you know, my partner, she runs the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, which is the biggest abortion provider in Britain. She's horrified by this.
Yeah.
You know, she hates what the guy did, but the idea that you try to fight his views by such censorious, you know, sort of almost totalitarian way, you know, ultimately it's self-defeating. It basically undermines your own legitimacy as somebody who believes in a woman's right to choose. If you have to resort to these kinds of measures, then you must be thinking that you haven't got a very strong argument.
Yes,
there.
Yes, the argument doesn't win itself anyway. Yeah, it's strange.
We're coming towards the end of the show, and I want to get in. I wanted to talk about whether or not you're optimistic or pessimistic for the future and where this is going, but let's talk about this around the idea that you've formed an organisation called the Manifesto Club, and let's talk about this. Tell us about this. Tell us where this idea came from and where you see it going.
Well, a bunch of my friends and I were kind of sitting around grumbling, you know, sort of one weekend, and we felt that, you know, we were developing some very interesting ideas that questioned the way things were. Mm-hmm. But we weren't really offering a positive alternative. You know, yes, you had to question what is happening, but you also had to be in a position where you're kind of providing a forum where the positive developments in society could be affirmed, could be celebrated, mm-hmm. and where people who wanted to ask difficult questions could be supported and encouraged. Because at the moment what happens is that you have individuals here and there who are saying the kind of things that we're talking about, but are pretty isolated. And so the Manifesto Club idea came about through that. It's the whole aim of the Manifesto Club is to create a network for individuals who really are, in the first instance, prepared to go against the grain, who still possess a strong positive view of what people are about, who are essentially humanist, mm-hmm. in whatever shape or form, and do believe that history is made not by nature or by God, but by you and I, people like us, and who also believe that the potential that humans have for altering their circumstances is a considerable one, and for which there's a lot of scope today. And I think what we're doing is we're trying to kind of create a humanist movement that is not like the old humanist movement, because you can't go back to the past, but is one that is very much fixed on the issues of our own times, our own 21st century.
So where do you actually see that develop? How do you see that developing?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because what's already happening is you have groups of individuals saying, you know, we want to set up a manifesto club. So we had, I just been in email contact with somebody from Norway this morning that said, look, you know, we need something like what you're doing in Norway. You know, sort of, is it okay if we kind of collaborate with you? And we've not had that in about 10 or 11 countries, people saying that we want to do it. We have people in different parts of England saying, let's run with it. And hopefully what we're going to do is to get together in November, where we're going to work out, cobble together a manifesto that we can all agree on as making sense, which will not be like a finished product, but will be like a jumping off point for other people to develop their own ideas in every sphere of cultural and political life. What we want to do is have an orientation that's very broad, that isn't just simply about party politics or not just about science, mm-hmm. but has got something to say about experimenting in the arts, experimenting in music, experimenting in education. So really what we're trying to do is to challenge the kind of things we've been discussing, but throughout every level of society and in all different institutions.
So can you give us there's a web address, isn't there, in a web form. Can you give us the website if people are interested and want to?
I can't, because I never remember a website, but I can give you my own website, which okay. has got a link to it, which is www.frankferedi.com. That's Frank, and then FURedi.com, and there's a link straight to the Manifesto Club. And if you go on the site, you'll see that there's all kinds of people in there. It's a very heterogeneous uh-huh. kind of group of individuals, all of them who have got the potential to run with their own thing.
Okay, well, thanks very much for being our guest on Little Atoms this afternoon, Frank.
And pleasure.
Frank, your current book is called, I'm trying to
it's called The Politics of Fear.
Politics of Fear,
and it's published by Continuum, I believe.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's out now. And I think we're just about at the end of the show. There was a couple of other things I wanted to talk about, but we've run out of time.
So if I can give our web address, which is www.littleatoms.com. Thanks to Alex for engineering for us today.
And thanks very much to Frank Faridi for appearing on the show. Thanks
Pleasure,
very much.
I enjoyed it.